None of us ever know. If any of us knew how to really get to the end of the rainbow on trying to measure true impact of any one thing, you'll be there forever.
Hey everyone, welcome to Shopify Masters. I'm your host, Shuang Esther Shan, and this is your companion for starting and building a business. If you strip all additives in plant-based milk, you get Malk, a clean alternative beverage using all organic ingredients. Ryan Rouse, Malk's president, has mastered the art of scaling direct-to-consumer food brands. You probably tried some of his work at Factor, a food delivery app acquired for over $200 million, or Hikey Snacks, where he served as chief marketing officer and then CEO. We are here to chat with Ryan on his strategies that are scaling Malk to nine figures. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here, Shuang.
So happy to have you here. We are all big fans of Erewhon smoothies. We've tasted the magic of Malk. So excited to get an understanding of your background and how you got here. Maybe walk us through your career a little bit, starting at Factor and how that has really shaped your experience and your approach to scaling D2C.
I spent 14 years in finance before starting Factor, and I think it's relevant because many people these days start a business right out of school. And I don't think there's a right way to do this. I think there's pros and cons to both. But I sort of cut my teeth in the corporate world before starting Factor. But in 2012, really, it was a friend of mine from college. It was his idea, right? He had done a lot of the heavy lifting on the initial sort of, what's the idea? What are we going to do? Started Factor, and that was a direct-to-consumer-only business. There is no other distribution option, not Amazon, not retail. And so it forced us to learn a lot about direct-to-consumer, you know, really all of it, brand building, you know, traffic, SEO, email, all sort of the toolbox of direct-to-consumer. And we learned the hard way. You know, we used a lot of our own money. We used some outside capital as well in the early years, but we really couldn't go, we didn't have the money to go hire very experienced people in critical portions of our business. So there's a lot of learnings, you know, to be had throughout the entire experience. But long story short, we did figure it out. And we went on to scale that brand. I left in 2017. It went on to have an exit in 2020 that you alluded to. HelloFresh acquired it. Really, really good outcome because we didn't raise a lot of outside capital. Everybody made money on that, which was great. And then, you know, since leaving Factor in 2017, I've been a part of a lot of different consumer brands, externally, internally. You know, you alluded to the Hikey experience, but the long story short is I've been a part of either in-house or out-house in an advisory or consultancy or internally on a lot of different traditional CPG brands, food and beverage mainly. And then I joined Malk about 14 months ago. So I was brought here. The CEO, Jason, is actually a friend going back about 6 years. He was a critical portion of really helping scale Malk. And you know, when I came on, it was to help lead the commercial side of the business. So sales and marketing, I think, and the data portion of the business to really, you know, take us from a brand that was very, very fast growing, had a fantastic product, great brand, great following. But, you know, what is it going to take for us to get from, you know, the 50 million, let's call it, to 250 or 300 million.
Yeah. Well, so much to unpack here because I like what you mentioned, right? There is no right or wrong path to build a business. And your story is unique because I think it's important to highlight those who've worked a long time in corporate, had the foundations, and then got into scrappy startups and helped them to scale. So from those experiences, what are you taking from them to build into Malk?
I think there's a really beneficial baseline of business understanding that comes from the corporate world. I think it's very common these days to hear on social media people not talking positively about corporate, right? There's obviously just entrepreneurship is very popular and owning your own destiny and all those types of things. And obviously, like I'm a big believer in those types of things, but there's a lot of benefits that can be had from starting in the corporate world, right? To learning what it takes to hierarchy at business, basic communication skills, calendar management. Those things are not taught in startups. And I think they can be really, really helpful. Also, and this can be good and bad, I made really good money in that career. And so I was able to sort of set myself up to then take a shot in a startup with the money that I had made up until that point. And you know, the downside of that, I guess, is that you go from making really good income with no kids to then a startup, then in my case, making $0 for close to 4 years and putting your money in, and then you have kids. So there's a lot to unpack there too, but the punchline is to the question, I think there's a lot of benefit to getting your feet under you as it relates to some basic business acumen, communication skills. I think you learn what you are good at and what you're not good at more at 28 than you maybe know at 18. So that maybe the opportunities that you see that you think you could really succeed at would shift during that time. And maybe you've got a little bit better clarity on that if you were to wait a little bit longer.
And I think, like, looking at your career after banking, you've chosen businesses that have scaled beautifully, but you also impacted that future because you were there to shape it. So I view it as like the nature nurture question of direct to consumer, right? It's like, yes, you chose great companies to be a part of, but you also were there and was able to implement strategies to help it reach that point. So I guess when we're talking about Malk, what is it about Malk that was attractive for you? And what are some things you're hoping to do to help it grow even more?
Yeah. Great question. You hit on a really important point, which is the product, the opportunities that you choose are going to have a much larger or outsized impact on your success trajectory than anything else. That's just plain and simple. The best operator, the best marketer, the best direct-to-consumer tactician cannot outpace a product that doesn't deserve to be on shelf. Right, you've got a headwind versus a tailwind. You've got all those things. It's a massive tailwind. So dovetailing into your question, what I saw in Malk was a fantastic product that deserved to be on shelf. In other words, there was a value proposition to Malk. It's a little bit different now, but at the time, there was no organic and clean label, simple ingredient, plant-based milk on shelf, right? And the consumer clearly wants that, as evidenced by our growth and the growth of that subcategory within the larger category. So when you step into any early stage business, it's safe to say that a universal truth is that it's chaos. There are a lot of things just not done. That's just part of early stage, right? There's so many, you could look around the room, so to speak, and identify 25 things that should be done better. That's early stage. So if you take that as truth, and those are probably the things that I think some of those things I can help fix and or scale and or improve, for it to be growing as fast as it was and to have the type of distribution and retail that it already had when I got here, despite a lot of those things in the room that had a lot of room for improvement, was really interesting to me. It is a retail-only business for the most part. We have a shelf-stable product that we launched last year. So we've got a small Amazon business, small e-commerce business on Amazon. But for the most part, it's retail. And in the retail game, you know, typical better-for-you brands, healthy health and wellness brands, start in the natural channel, think Whole Foods and Sprouts. And then the hope is that you can bridge the gap to more conventional retailers like your Targets and your Krogers and your Albertsons. And they had made that jump with their core products. So all those things added up to a situation where I felt like my superpower comes in the form of sales, scale, brand, messaging. And there was room to improve those things. But even at the level that they were at, to see the type of traction that they had gotten was really, really exciting for me. And then my thought in my head anyway was, if I can add these things, right? It's a fairly boring category, milk. It just is. That's fine. It's fairly sterile. So what if we added some energy and excitement and curiosity? What if we became less boring? Would that help? And that was sort of the hypothesis I have going in, is if I can help bring that through team, through some of my superpowers, then what will that do to the trajectory of the business?
Yeah, I think it's also interesting to think about this category from the lens of the consumer, right? For so long, we just wanted milk alternatives and we didn't really care what was going in the milk alternatives. And then there was this shift during COVID almost that people were highlighting all of these additives were actually causing, you know, different issues that they didn't notice before. And actually, Malk has been there all along. With ingredients you can recognize, you can read, and you can understand, and didn't have all of those additives. So how were you reacting to also the consumer's realization and also maybe change the way that you've presented the brand to consumers?
Yes, it's a really good point because most new brands in food and beverage are better for you brands, right? They're healthier than the incumbent on shelf in some way, shape, or form. And especially entrepreneurs who we are by nature optimists and typically passionate about health and wellness. That's the journey that got an entrepreneur to start a brand in food and beverage, traditionally, typically. And because of that optimism, I think that we believe that the consumer has evolved their thinking in every category. The reality is it's just not true in every category. Right? And some categories are further along on that slope. Some are behind and some just aren't there yet. And some will never get there. Some categories, for whatever reason, the consumer is just never going to care enough about a clean version of that thing to start paying with their wallet. So I say all that to say this movement in plant-based milk that you alluded to has been a massive tailwind for Malk. I wouldn't be arrogant enough to say that Malk created that, but we're certainly participating in it. And we are one of few brands on shelf that actually adhere to those things that the consumer has now cared about. So big backdrop to the answer. But what I would say is, Malk, before I got here, relied heavily on that messaging. You're right. The reality is this category of plant-based milk, alternative milks, started with a few brands that, and this could be said for really any trend, right? Their main message point was it's not dairy, right? Wasn't talking about what was or what wasn't in their milk from an ingredient perspective. It was just not dairy and therefore it's healthy. Gluten-free has gone through that. Keto has gone through that, whereby like that in and of itself is not mean it's healthy, right? For people who can't handle dairy, sure, it's maybe a bit healthier. But at the end of the day, the ingredient deck will speak to whether a product is healthy or not. And it just not having dairy in it isn't enough. But that is how this category started, with brands saying it's not dairy, therefore it's healthy. To your point, don't know how or why, but the consumer started turning the label around, you know, turning to the back of the label and saying, actually, the ingredients in here aren't healthy necessarily. And so there's pros and cons to that if you have a product that actually is a clean label, organic, simple ingredient product in that category, because some consumers tried it under that premise and then got put off by it because they felt like they were lied to maybe a little bit. And so maybe they move away from alt milk or plant-based milk in general. But I say all that to say that certainly the trend is going in our direction where the consumer does care about the subcategory of clean label in plant-based milk. So Malk before me really focused on that element. This is what's not in the bottle, right? We don't have gums, we don't have fillers, we don't have oils, right? It is just the water, the almonds, the salt in the case of our almond milk. When I got here, I felt like we had an opportunity to add in this concept of taste, which sort of sounds like a, of course you would do that, but when you're in it, it's hard to read the label from inside the bottle, right? And so when you get here, you say, you know, the thing that people care most about with food and beverage is what it tastes like. That is what they care the most about. Is it good? Ours is fantastic. So we don't have to just rely on the fact that what's missing does matter, right, from our bottle, but what's in it also does. And so we have a lot more creative assets now, and we did a number of, we made a big push into messaging, to highlighting taste on messaging. And we made a big push into a lot of our creative assets to show the liquid pouring into a delicious matcha or a coffee or a bowl of cereal or a glass for that matter, because while what's missing matters, and we talk about that a lot, what is not on the label matters quite a bit.
Yeah, highlighting the taste, it sounds simple, but it is a big shift in the mindset of building the brand, right? So now you have this direction. How are you relaying that direction into other aspects of the business?
Yeah, a lot of it, you know, at the end of the day, as you start building out sort of brand assets, and I mean internal facing assets, like what is our messaging hierarchy? Who is our customer? What do they care about? And that changes by channel. Right? The natural channel customer cares about different things than the conventional customer cares about. But what you want to have is a internal facing document, call it a brand Bible. There's a lot of different names for it that really highlight the message points that you want to convey. Then you decide by channel, by creative asset, how much space do you have? How many of those you want to talk about? The label's a great example, the packaging, right? You can't say all those things at the same time. So you have to pick which ones matter. So for me, it's about a lot of the heavy lifting can and should be done on the creative assets itself. If it's a video, if it's an image, you can and should take some of those things on your brand Bible, on the things that you want to convey to the customer, and have it baked in implicitly in the creative asset. So that anyone anytime looks at something, it's subtle, right? But I happen to have someone that leads our brand efforts who is phenomenal at this. So love him for that. That's Barrett. He knows how to do that. Then you start talking about words, you know? And so then it's really just the what channel is this on? Who's the audience? Which of these things that we know are our pillars of communication and our value proposition, which do we think matter most on this particular asset? And that's based on who it's going to, how it's being used. And then you just sort of just plug and play, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's like, once you also have that brand mindset, it's how you elevate it, you know, even through socials or different posts and like highlighting the right user generated content to make sure it reflects back as well.
Yeah, totally. We have the luxury of a lot of people create UGC with our product, right? Obviously, we're paying for some of those, but we're not paying for a lot of the things that people see. For example, like Glenn Powell from Maverick, he's been in a lot of movies, but you know, very, very popular. Everyone knows. Yeah, everyone knows who Glenn Powell is. But he was on a segment, What's in Your Fridge? We knew nothing about it. All of a sudden, he opens his fridge up and Malk's in there, which is cool. So those types of things are happening regularly where you're just there. We didn't seek that out. We didn't try to pay for that. That was a placement in a very organic setting where we're like, holy cow, like that's in that person's fridge. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is so cool. I mean, I obviously mentioned at the top of the show about Air One and their infamous smoothies, but there's so many content where people are trying Air One smoothies and they're reading out the ingredients and they're like, and it has Malk and things like that. So there's just so much impact that the brand has had in social media, in the way that people are interacting with it in different ways.
Totally. Air One is a constant jumping off point for communication. It's a topic of conversation in the industry, generally speaking, right? Because everyone in CPG knows the Erewhon smoothie thing. And so I'm asked about it a lot, right? Is it impactful? And the way that I answer that is always the same. I mean, none of us ever know. If any of us knew how to really get to the end of the rainbow on trying to measure true impact of any one thing, you'll be there forever. What I love to deploy from a marketing or growth perspective are things that generate revenue and have a brand awareness element to it. Now, again, how much it has of each, it depends on the thing. How much can you tell and or measure depends on the thing, not always 100%. But Erewhon Smoothies is one of those things where, as a retailer, they carry our product. People buy it off their shelves. We make money, revenue and profit from selling product inside of Erewhon. Cool, right? They're less profitable than another retailer that doesn't have this smoothie thing going on, right? But that's okay. We're measuring it differently because we're saying we also believe that they have this, what many would consider marketing lever that we can pull with the smoothies that just generates a lot of conversation in the marketplace and generates a lot of brand awareness that we can't put our finger on exactly how much it's generating for us, but we don't have to because we believe it's true and gut has to play a big part in this game of business. It just has to. It's inevitable. And we know we're making money by selling it on the shelf there. So we don't really have to, because it's hard when you are choosing to do maybe a brand awareness type of initiative where there is no point of sale element. There's no ability to track whether it's been successful or not from a dollars and cents perspective. So your entire rubric that you would use to measure the success of that is just gut. And that's hard. So to me, if we can add some analytics, some revenue, some point of sale to anything that we try to do, but we also believe there's some brand awareness elements to it, it just makes it easier to assess whether or not it was successful or not.
And also to that, right, they are such a powerful retailer. They can choose any brand to use anytime. But to maintain that relationship, I guess, yeah, like tell us a little bit how that relationship even came to be and how you maintain it for them to constantly be using Malk and showcasing the brand.
Yes. Heather Seiler is our VP of sales. She was a very early employee at Malk when Jason got here. So there's sort of two, you know, from 2020, I guess I would say, this sort of the scaling phase of Malk. So I chalk it all up to her. Heather formed that relationship with executives at Erewhon. She has owned that relationship, and she has, you know, it's sort of old school. Like a lot of this retail game is old school. It's getting a little bit harder because of brokers and intermediaries in between the true buyer and, you know, the brand. But in the case of Erewhon, it was very much old school. Like Heather built that relationship, established our value proposition, and then has continued to nurture that relationship so that we have a very, very strong personal relationship there. And look, our product sells, right? I mean, relationships only go so far. But that's the short answer, is that Heather built that relationship with the people that matter at Erewhon. She has continued to nurture that relationship. And because we've also had success selling on their shelves, they understand that we stand for something. We have a true differentiator. That gets back to our initial conversation, whereby, you know, if you really have a value proposition in the marketplace that people care about, it provides that tailwind that makes a lot of things easier, because now we don't have to sell Erewhon as hard, I guess, to include us, because they know their customer. And when a retailer comes to you and says, this is our customer, this is what we care about, and we fit, it's easier. We are a perfect match for their customer. They care about health and wellness. They don't want bad ingredients, but they also want it to taste great. Then it's just, you know, yes, all the relationship matters. It matters a ton, and the building and nurturing of that. But also the other side is, does your product have a value proposition that matches with the cares of the consumer at that retailer?
Yeah, it's very exciting to hear kind of behind the scenes. Obviously, a big part of the business, retail. There's some direct-to-consumer sales with being on the marketplace with Amazon, but you've recently launched a site on Shopify, kind of leading you down a new path. Talk to us about that process.
Yes. When I got here, because we don't have a direct-to-consumer or e-commerce sales channel available to us, or said differently, one that we choose to leverage. It's refrigerated beverage. Like it's expensive to stand up anything and ship directly to the consumer. We may one day, never say never. But that's a distribution thing. I still believe wholeheartedly that a lot of the direct-to-consumer toolkit can and should be used, no matter if you actually sell direct-to-consumer. So what does that mean? When I got here, we had a site on WordPress. We weren't building an email list, right? And our site wasn't shoppable, which I can understand if you're coming in and sort of maybe a little bit not as open-minded, that you would say, well, why would we do those things if we sell in retail? And I would argue that those tools are necessary to build a consumer brand regardless of whether you sell on direct-to-consumer or not. So Barrett, who I brought up earlier, I'd worked with him in a previous journey. We know, like, and trust each other. At least I hope he likes me. We come from that world. And so we immediately decided that we needed to start to incorporate a lot of direct-to-consumer tools into Malk. First and foremost, website. Build it on Shopify. Why? Because it's just the best. It just is, for all the reasons that if you know it, you know. We know that people still come to your site to do research regardless of if you sell there, right? if someone hears about your brand, whether it's through UGC from Erewhon or Glenn Powell's, you know, segment on whatever show that was, or a friend, their neighbor, they're going to go to your website. They're going to do their research on your website. And I don't think we were putting our best foot forward from a brand messaging perspective. Now we are. But to us, there is some good technology. Advancements are our friend in some cases, right? And so we now have the ability, we have a store locator. That's great. You know, people, if they're going to do their research, they're going to figure out where you sell and if that matches up to where they live and where they shop. We've also added the ability for people to add to cart right from our website. So using something like Smart Commerce, we're able to then have people, it's geolocating their IP address. It knows which retailers were not only available in, but also in stock in, that's near the IP address of the user that's on the site. And it will immediately pop up the .com of that retailer and they can add right to cart, whether that's Instacart, which is sort of, you know, a catch-all, but or a Target.com or a Walmart.com or a Kroger and et cetera, any of the retailers. So we now, what does that do? A couple things. It reduces friction for that user, right, to be able to add something to their cart. Obviously, it gives them a breadth of availability around them, which they may not execute against them, i.e. they may not buy on site at that time, but they now know where we're available and hopefully that matches up with where they shop. But also it gives us a data point. To the point I was making earlier, rarely do you have a full breadth of like dollars spent over here and revenue driven over there. It's very rare you have a full through line. If you're direct to consumer only, that's the only time in which you have a through line. And even then it's murky, right? We spent on ads over here and it drove these kind of sales. It's not as uniform and elegant as that. But in retail only, you don't have that. And so this gives us a data point that says we drove traffic to our site. How long did they stay there? How many added to cart? And even though we can't see the final purchase, again, we're making decisions based on incomplete information all the time in running a business. So the more information we do have, the better able to make decisions we are. So that gives us a look. It's like, oh, this many people added to cart. And so now we can start to sort of adjust platform spending, amount of spending around a metric at least. That's not the Bible of metrics. It's not the end all be all, but it's something.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot more dynamic and actually having data to be presented from the site. And to your point, you know, this is not something easily shipped. So linking them closer to retailers, closer to delivery services, it's such a cool solution, and it's so creative to think about direct-to-consumer and e-commerce in this way.
Yeah, I do think that what I was saying earlier, so then we started an email list. We did a lot of the things that if you're in the direct-to-consumer universe, these are the first things that you do.
Table stakes, yeah.
Table stakes, 100%. I think they're table stakes no matter where you distribute. So the fact, that's one of those things when you say what was interesting to me about Malk, look, I don't think building an email list is going to bring us from 50 to 250 million, but it's not going to hurt, right? A connection with our consumer, sending out content. These table stakes things, I think, regardless of whether you sell on that channel or not, are the D2C isn't only about selling on a sales channel, I guess is what I will say. It's about connection with your consumer and whether you actually use it to send product to the consumer shouldn't remove the fact that you should connect with your consumer through that. So I think that there was a ton of value in us pushing into what many would consider to be a D2C toolkit, even though we don't sell D2C. It's really about community building, awareness building, connection, research again with the consumer. All those things are part of the D2C toolkit that I don't think as many people talk about because it's a lot of times right about, you know, running ads to a page and CRO and email and retention strategies. All those things matter, don't get me wrong, but those tools can be used for more than just that.
Yeah. Well, maybe talk to us a bit more about other tools that sometimes, whether it's new founders, whether it's more traditional CPG brands, they sometimes overlook and maybe kind of miss when they're trying to build or scale.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, sales channel diversification is a big one, especially I think with this audience. And trust me, I came from a world like I started a true D2C brand during the time that D2C became a big thing and very, very popular. And so I certainly was in the camp of people who kind of like as a D2C or die type of person. But I think diversification of sales channels is an incredibly important thing in consumer, in particularly in consumer packaged goods, in food and beverage. That direct-to-consumer is a great way to start, to build, in some cases to scale, right? But ultimately, you have a much smaller total addressable market if you're D2C only. And so one that I would say is Amazon. It sort of makes me chuckle a little bit that this is still a conversation. But, you know, 10 years ago it was, you know, you want to stay D2C only, no to Amazon. Even though it's a different shopper in many cases, and even though all you really need to do, you need scale to succeed in consumer, you need scale wherever that's going to come. And so while you may have preferences on where that person shops, you shouldn't let that limit where you make yourself available. So I would say Amazon qualifies as a massive scalable channel that founders should explore if they're only on D2C, because the lift of that is very, very low and you have control of how to enter that. Retail is a different conversation altogether, but I do think that there are ways to enter retail in more grassroots ways than people might expect, than going to large retailers. So, the big punchline takeaway here is I think you need to think about diversifying channels maybe a bit earlier than people think, and maybe a bit earlier than people were doing 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, because the reality is like costs of advertising are going up. And it's not as tenable as it used to be to really scale to a fairly decent number direct to consumer only, because you really are paying that tax. That's the tax that you're paying is advertising channels, and namely Facebook/Meta.
Yeah. I almost view, obviously, diversification, it helps you to scale. It also helps you to de-risk. But it's almost kind of like managing separate businesses in a way sometimes. How do you make sure, you know, you're nurturing the relationships appropriately, you're also growing the channels in the way that they need, and you're kind of balancing all of these things at the same time?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we're talking about resource management and human resource, including human resource management at the end of the day, right? In a perfect world, and it never is perfect, but in a perfect world, you're sort of taking a big bite out of something, one big bite at a time, not all at the same time. And so you say, hey, we've sort of stood up, let's just say in a world where you stood up your direct-to-consumer capabilities as an internal company and you feel strong. Like, of course, there's things that can be better, right? But the 80-20 is done. You have the people in place that know what they're doing, whether it's agency, contractor, full-time, and that thing's running. Then and only then, maybe focus on a net new channel, right? Because to your point, like it has supply chain implications, it has people implications. So at the end of the day, what I would do over again at Factor, had I had the time to go back, could I go backwards in time? It was hire experienced people in the major functions of our business sooner, right? Like, you would need to bring in people. It doesn't have to be full-time. There can be consultants. There's a host of different ways to execute against this, but founders like to get up learning curves. I'm one of them. I love the journey of getting up a new learning curve. However, at some point, you have to decide and be aware of if it's holding you back. So if you're going to get into anything net new, you're talking about sales distribution, but it can be used for anything, then someone at the table who has experience with that thing, so that you're not, as a company, dealing with the learning curve 100%, it matters. So who can we bring in who knows this channel, who can help us advise on where we have gaps, whether it's supply chain or finance or sales, and can help guide us along the way a little bit more, so that yes, we obviously have some sort of learning curve, but it's not total learning curve.
Yeah, it's also that mind shift, right? Like, I feel like founders are such DIYers. They want to like do everything, learn everything. But sometimes in order to actually scale, you can also let other people in and grow together. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's an element of like, are you doing that for you or for the business?
Yeah, it's a big ego check.
Which is a rabbit hole. It's a rabbit hole and a half because you just never really know. And there's many times along my journey that I've said, I'm absolutely doing this for the business. When if I could look backwards in time now, I'm like, maybe I was doing it for me. But yeah, there's I'm good at this. Everything else I've worked up the learning curve. Why wouldn't I be able to do it here? And the question is not whether you can or cannot do it. Obviously, if you have a track record of working up learning curves, you can. The question is, should you? Like at this point in the maturation of the business, should you work up that learning curve or should you not?
No, that's a good thought to think about. I also want to zoom out a little bit and just thinking about CPG, direct to consumer, everything in general. Right now it's a hard time for brands to get funding. It is also a bit harder to scale. We talk about, you know, your vision going from a 50 to 250 million brand reaching that nine figures. How should founders think about scaling with investors and building out runways on their own and just like the overall environment right now?
Totally. I mean, I think Factor is actually a very good case study for this. The reality is we tried to raise institutional capital, VC capital, and VCs weren't interested. Turns out that probably was a benefit to us, although who knows, because we didn't live that experience. We only have the one that we did. So my advice would be, I do think it's incredibly helpful to have some amount of capital to launch a food and beverage business, right? I think it's less than you would probably go raise from a VC, because the reality is they want to cut a certain check size and it's probably more than you need, but that's what they want to do. However much you determine that to be, I think the path to sort of launching and scaling a consumer brand is through individual investors. Friends and family is used quite often, so I'll use that liberally, right? It could be 5 degrees of separation for you, but it's an individual, not an institution. They are not in the business of investing in businesses and making money doing that. They are individual people who might invest in yours for whatever reasons they choose to do that. I think, I'm not going to say it's easy. I don't want to diminish how hard this is to A, raise money, to put yourself in front of people you don't know and tell them to invest in you, the time that it takes to do that. It's a lot. But I think it's way more possible than people give credit to it for to do that, to go raise $1 million. You just have to go get it. Like you really, what I would have done differently, we did raise capital from individual investors at Factor. To go backwards in time, I would have raised more earlier. I would have filtered that list less on my own. And what I mean by that is because it's hard, because all the things I said, it's hard, it's embarrassing, it's all the things, like asking people for money, I would put these constraints in front of a name versus letting them do it. In other words, friend of a friend of a friend, or like a family person, uncle, so-and-so. We didn't have money as a family, so it's not like that was an option, but I think you get the broader point where I would be like, oh, well, uncle so-and-so, he wouldn't want to do this. Versus like, he's an adult. He can make that determination. And unless you're making promises to him that are just not real, then you should pitch him and let him decide. So all that's to say, I think it's an easier path. There are certainly plenty of examples of people who have bootstrapped consumer businesses very successfully. But most brands need some amount of capital, $500,000, $1 million, to just make that path a little bit easier. And I think it's very possible to go get $500,000 to $1 million from people who are some degrees of separation from your personal network. You just got to exhaust all of it. And you almost have to be unadulterated in your conviction to go do that. And I think a lot of times it's just people stop shorter than, you know, they stop sooner than they should in trying to raise that. Because look, the reality is it takes a long time. It's just a process. And most people just want to be done with the process. And I understand that. You just want to run your business. But it's probably very, very going to come in handy that you have some amount of buffer and capital to, you know, scale into retail or to hire experienced people or any of the other list of reasons you would need it. So I think it's accessible to more people than they would give it credit for if they really put their head down and say, I'm just going to go do this.
Yeah, it is a muscle that you constantly have to exercise. And also, yeah, like removing the mindset away from VC, there are so many more people. And it's just about kind of like being diligent and reaching out to even people beyond your comfort levels as well. Well, looking forward to all the exciting things. What are you excited more about, Malk, and new things that you want to try out to try to reach that nine-figure point?
Yeah. So we're quickly approaching that and trailing 12-month revenue, which is really, really exciting and fun, and it's chaos, you know, and all the things. I'm excited about our team. You know, I think when you get to a point where you're financially very sound, right? You've got cash on the balance sheet, you're profitable, you have the ability to go bring on really experienced, really good people. And when you have a brand that's growing as fast as we are, that opportunity, as we talked about before, right? Identifying opportunities is going to have, it matters. We can go get really, really capable people, really smart people. And that's fun. I never got to experience that at Factor. You know, when I left the day-to-day, we were still in that, like, we don't have a lot of money. We can't go hire a bunch of really smart people. I imagine that was fun. I always imagined that part was fun. And it turns out that it is, because we're doing that here at Malk. I'm very excited to explore what's next for us. We're in the process of doing that. We've got a lot of time and energy dedicated to where do we believe we've earned the right to play? What other categories do we believe we've earned the right to play? What brand equity have we built such that we can enter this space and go win? And then, of course, what value proposition do we hold in that space? That's the exciting part. You know, to me, I'm addicted to this game of business, and the game of business is a lot of fun. And if you ever think that the sort of chaotic nature of it goes away, or that it gets like a lot more organized, I think you're setting yourself up for disappointment, because it just doesn't. But if you can learn really to enjoy that, and you say, okay, we're sort of past the point where financially we might not make it, we're in a really, really great spot. Now, again, who should we bring on? Like, what should we do next, right? What's important to this business? Who do we need in order to do that? How quickly can we go get them? That's just an operating system of how to prioritize the right things at the right time in a business, and that's what's addicting to me. So when I say I'm excited about that, that's just like how to run a business, in my opinion, but that's also very, very exciting.
Yeah, it's infectious, and I think it's also such a healthy mindset, because I can tell that you have fun doing this versus for some other people, scaling a business is chaotic, it's stressful. To finally kind of wrap everything up and close things off, how do you maintain that essence of fun? Because it is a hard thing to do to scale a business.
My journey alone, Factor was not fun for me. For Nick either. Nick is the true founder of Factor, and I came on pre-revenue. Why wasn't it fun is because we let our personal balance sheet get turned upside down in the process of starting the business. In other words, we both went into very deep personal debt to continue to fund the business. And I was given that advice very early on. So let's retro back to your question of like, what other things would you tell maybe early stage founders as a watch out? Someone told me when we first started Factor, don't let your personal balance sheet, in other words, don't go into like deep personal debt. You can maintain your living expenses and sort of bring that down and manage that. Yes, that I would suggest everybody do that, but don't go into heavy debt, because the stresses and the chaos of an early stage business that is going to be financially unstable is hard enough. So if you're also dealing with that at home, it might be too much. And I would say that was my experience at Factor. My entire time there, like I had no kids when we started. My firstborn, I have three kids now, but my first daughter was born 2 months after we launched. My second daughter was born 17 months later. And so now I go from having no kids and doing well financially to having two and eventually three kids and not well financially, plus the business is chaotic. So I say all that to say, I didn't have any fun. I mean, there certainly were periods. I love the people we were building with. We had a lot of success eventually. And like, I can look back fondly on that. But at the time, it wasn't fun. I was holding on so tight. white-knuckling everything. So since leaving that, and I've said this to the team here at Mall quite a bit, I'm not doing that again. Like, I am not going to not enjoy it. And look, part of that comes with, we are in a great financial situation as a company. I am not in deep financial debt just to get this company going. So those things matter, but mindset matters too. And I just made it a point to myself, like, I won't do that again. If I choose to stay in this space, which is early stage consumer, then I'm making a conscious choice to do that, which means I like it. If I like it, act like it, right? Enjoy it. This is the fun part. I will look back. I say it to my team all the time. You will look back at this 2 to 3 year run that we're having for the rest of your life and be like, man, that was fun. Like, that was a really, really fun stretch. So try to the extent that you can enjoy it while we have it, because it's fleeting. That could go for anything in life, right? These moments of highs are fleeting. And so while you have them, you should enjoy it.
Yeah. Savor those fun, fleeting moments. Thank you so much for being here today, Ryan.
Thanks. I enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun.
Our show is produced by Gogo Zoger and Alicia Clark. Our engineers are Miku Betlam and Matt Schwartz. And I'm your host, Shuang Esther Shan. Come hang out with us every Tuesday and Thursday for brand new episodes. You're going to want to subscribe to stay on top of it. Also, check us out on YouTube. We got plenty of video interviews for you to binge. Thank you so much.